Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to have with me the two authors of the book titled China and Latin America, Development, Agency, and Geopolitics, just out from Bloomsbury. And this book, as the title suggests, unlocks the current interactions between China and various countries in Latin America, but also situates them in historical context, in relation to each other, and really helps us understand the many ties between China and the multiple countries of Latin America, Central America, the Caribbean, all sorts of places. So I'm very pleased to have with me today Dr. Chris Alden and Dr. Alvaro Mendez to tell us all about their book. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you for the invitation.
Before we get into the book, I was wondering if you could each introduce yourselves a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book and write it together. Alvaro, why don't you start us off?
Hi, my name is Alvaro Mendez. I'm the director of the London School of Economics Global South Unit, and I'm delighted to be here. I've been working on this topic for more than 10, 15 years, and I've been working with Chris for almost more than two decades, a little bit over two decades. So that's why we've been writing on this topic together for a while.
In my case, I have been working, as Alvaro said, together on this issue of China and the Global South, but my focus had been China-Africa. He and I had been invited to do some presentations and workshops across Latin America. And in that context, I had become more aware of Latin America as a whole, as an actor involving China, though I brought work on Africa to that. We talked together during one of these trips and said, you know, we were doing this frequently. I knew a bit about Brazil as well. Alvaro and I decided to pool our expertise and do this book on China, Latin America.
A great that combination.
Great combination, especially because we have done a lot of field work. I mean, the topic is right now in fashion, but we've been working on this, and this is the result of around 6-7 years of field work in Latin America, including China as well, and other parts of the world.
And that very much shows in the book, both in the breadth and the depth that you get into with the number of case studies and also tying it all together. So hopefully we can do a decent job of a sort of highlights tour of the main points of the book to showcase that. So I'd like to start sort of going vaguely chronologically with the history of this, because the both of you in the book make a really good point that we can't understand what's happening currently without understanding the older links between China and Latin America. So would you mind giving us sort of a brief run through of kind of those main points?
Chris, go ahead, I think.
Sure, I'll jump in. I think that situating the role of China in Latin America in the historical context is absolutely crucial. It's one of the most neglected elements of any studies that we saw, and that's why our start jumping off point was to look at that in greater detail. One of the points that comes across when you read the history is you realize how contemporary views across Latin America, across the scholarly world, suggest that China is quote unquote a new actor. Our findings was quite the opposite, that China is a very old actor, in fact, formative actor when it comes to Latin America. What do we mean by that? Well, the Spanish and Portuguese conquistadors, we tend to forget when you're situated in Latin America that really their aim and drive was to get to that Asian market. That's what in the 15th and 16th century was driving them to search for Latin America. That became they did settle in the so-called New World, but they took that as a jumping off point to continue trade, very high levels of trade of resources, Latin American resource in exchange for finished goods, for silk, for porcelain, for other spices and other things. And the parallel that 200 years of that extensive trade gave to our understanding of the contemporary relationship, which in so many ways still has echoes of that historical positioning between the three continents, between Asia, Latin America, and then European markets in the final analysis. So that was very intriguing for us. That was followed by a period which really embedded the communities that you will find today in contemporary Latin America, the communities of the descendants of migrants from the 19th century who were brought as indentured servants and laborers to the plantations, to the mines, and ultimately to build the infrastructure of the newly independent states in the region. And small communities in Peru, Mexico, Argentina, Brazil, other places cropped up at this stage. So that carries us through the 19th century and the 20th century, which I'll turn over to Alvaro, was, you know, Latin America was very much affected by the Cold War, and in particular, the Sino-Soviet dynamics. Alvaro.
Yes, I think that's a very good summary of what China's presence in Latin America in historical context. More recently, since 1949, the first thing that the PRC wanted was diplomatic recognition. So that was part of the relationship with Latin America. The first encounter that they actually had with Latin America was in 1952. China has been very good at using cultural diplomacy to reach out to the global south. And in 1952, they organized a conference in Beijing called the Asia and the Pacific Regional Conference. And it was actually very important because it was sort of the first opportunity for many people from the region to attend this conference in China. A total of 110 delegates from different countries. And now this is way before any of these countries in Latin America established diplomatic ties. Moving forward, China was a little bit shy about getting close to Latin America because they thought two things. Well, obviously, the distance, which is something that actually exists, but they thought we were closer to the US than what we are. And that particular element started to change as they started seeing the behavior of the U.S. in Latin America with the 1954, the Guatemala removal of Jacobo Arbenz and the different instances in which the U.S. intervened in the Caribbean. The key element, I believe, was 1960, when Cuba decided to establish diplomatic ties with the People's Republic of China, September 1960. Then you started people getting more interested in China. Che Guevara went to Beijing in October 1960. And then after that, a number of things also all oriented to China getting diplomatic recognition. Another important point was 1971, when China was able to gain membership of the UN. Although many countries from the Global South voted to support that, Latin America was part of that, and that's an important element, how they obtained that support. And this historical relationship became about then developing close ties. Then many countries established diplomatic ties with China. By 1979, when the U.S. established diplomatic ties with Beijing, 12 countries in the region already had diplomatic ties with China. So that's the context of that. And we continue seeing that diplomatic history as a very important element between China and Latin America. Just maybe important to mention that there are 33 countries in Latin America, 25 of which have diplomatic ties with Beijing. And of course, the other 8 with Taiwan, which we will probably discuss later on as well.
Can I jump in with a final additional point on there, and which is that during the Cold War period, as Beijing and Moscow split, the left within Latin America was itself divided. It had so in that respect that the machinations of Sino-Soviet problems were replicated within the political environments of each of these countries. And it carried on through that period and made the left a weaker overall, couldn't be as unified. Secondly, you had this kind of romanticism that members of the left had vis-a-vis China, that it's perhaps most clear representation was the Sendero Luminoso, the Shining Path, where Guzman, who was a member of the Peruvian Communist Party, had gone to China in 65 and 67 at the height of the Cultural Revolution, absolutely enamored about what he heard. And he took the ideology and launched, brought it back to Peru and eventually put it into practice, or as he understood it, in the highlands of Peru. And we had the insurgency that carried on really quite a bloody struggle for well into the early 90s. And so this kind of influence and the ideological overhang and the romanticism in some cases, ironically perhaps, was something that the Chinese experienced in like the Bolivarian republics, Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, for instance, which responded to China's economic engagement in the 1990s and early 2000s with, immediately identifying China with that radical past, which, of course, was not fully accurate to how China was responding, how China of that period was. But they still had that vision and that shared outlook.
And just to add before we discuss other things, Chris is absolutely right. That cultural diplomacy, people from the region visiting China, very important. Salvador Allende went to China in the 1950s. There are records that showing that Jacobo Arbenz, the former president of Guatemala, which was ousted from power with the help of the U.S., also is reported to have been in China in the 1960s. So that very important element of connection was there from the very beginning, often through friendship groups China has reached out to the Global South very often through these groups of friendship. And again, they continue doing so, which is remarkable. So this has depth. It's not a new relationship that people believe is just being established a few years ago.
And I think that's what's so important. And it's why I asked that as the first question, right? Establishing this foundation that might be contrary to what people think, but then allows the book to look at, as you said, Alvaro, the 33 different countries involved in a way that makes sense of sort of the links between them rather than just kind of each country having its own chapter, which would make for a long book. And I'm glad you didn't do that. And not only do you not have one chapter per country, but you also have unifying kind of threads, I suppose, throughout the book. And you talk about them in the introduction, which is very helpful. And I was wondering if you could discuss these now, the four main features that you investigate throughout the book and when looking at particular bilateral relationships.
Sure. We look at, we start this with a discussion of development and how development is a crucial driver, certainly as of both countries, actually, economic, and it's read through economic cooperation, gains, investment, technology transfer, and that sort of thing. And that shared outlook is really part of that glue that brings them together. And indeed, the openness with which China experienced unexpectedly in some ways, and the effort to narrow their focus in the language of economic cooperation, right? Because there was that careful treading into a region where the United States was perceived to have dominant interests and no desire to trigger U.S. Reactions in overreactions or reactions in that way. So development was the common project that brought Chinese development finance, technical expertise, and in some cases investment, and matching up with underinvestment that had featured in areas like sectors like the infrastructure. So there was the pulling together of those two and other dimensions in other sectors as well. The other one is agency. And agency is a recognition that this is a partnership that Latin American states and often elites, of course, but beyond elites, certainly reacted to, responded to the Chinese opportunities or the threats, if you like, opportunities as I've just described them, economic kind of new finance and the like, but threats were often read very locally in terms of a project, a mining project that might spill over into environmental area, often into remote areas where indigenous communities were based. And that because of that, we see a kind of pressure brought to bear, sometimes protests, sometimes picked up in the parliaments or national assemblies. But this just capturing this dynamic, this pattern of elite agency in terms of reaching out to the Chinese or finding points of contact between them, or sometimes rebuffing in certain sectors, saying, look, we're not interested in this particular involvement in the security domain, which happened time and time again across the countries of particularly of South America on the coastal Pacific side. But this agency as read through trade unions, communities, some small businesses or medium-sized businesses that saw in China some kind of threat to their business, to their livelihoods, to aspects of their community. And that give and take is really the sort of expressions of agency that we saw, patterns of agency that we saw across the continent. On geopolitics, I know Alvaro has more depth and things to say on that subject.
Yeah, we try to touch a number of issues. And as you can imagine, the diversity is quite, you know, massive, as you mentioned before, 33 countries, 33 different stories. So we try to put them together in a way that will be clear to the reader, touching issues of history, geopolitics, which we argue in the book were part of the relationship from the very beginning, which we also argue they're part of the relationship to today because it involves more than one actors, such as not just China, but also the US and other important actors that have had a relationship in the region. And of course, a story of trade and investment and cooperation, which goes back to what Chris said at the beginning, development. That's still a key element that makes China a very attractive proposition, China's different projects, because of the lack of development in the region. We have one of the poorest infrastructures in the entire world, and we are the region of the world that invests the least amount of GDP per capita per year on infrastructure. Therefore, you know, initiatives such as the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the New Development Bank, and of course the Chinese flagship Belt and Road Initiative, which doesn't have that much to offer because we don't really know what it is. But 21 countries in the region out of those 25 that have diplomatic ties with China have endorsed the plan. Yeah. So that's all these elements that we found. We tried to put together in an edition that is not ideologically based, Miranda. We're super critical of all the different actors, the US, the Europeans when they are involved, China, and Latin American countries. So that I think that gives you, and I'm sure when you read it, you saw that balance in which we were very open and critical of all the different actors, and that's very important. But finally, and you also mentioned that, it's a story of diversity. And to really understand the relationship with Latin America, you have to sort of look country by country. And we try to do that as much as possible to be able to do this in a fairly not so extensive edition that people can read and access. But it is important to remember that if you want to learn more about a particular case, country, you need to be looking a little bit further than simply looking at the region.
Mm. Very good points there that give a view of how you've managed to do the depth and breadth across these number of different countries and the complexity of the relationships with China. So I was wondering if we could delve a little bit more into the links in some ways over time, some of the legacies of the history, the things that happened before now, when the politics maybe were different, when the trade goals were different. What are some of the legacies of the longer history than we might realize between China and various Latin American countries that are actually very much still entwined with politics and relations today? Are there maybe a few particular examples you could tell us about?
I think that it's the shape of trade patterns, right, which are reasserting themselves. Remember, trade patterns have been first and foremost north-south, dominated by Europe and then the United States since in the late 19th and, well, in the formative years, continuing into the 20th century. But at the same time, Latin America was positioned in between European markets as a provider of goods, commodities, fundamental commodities in exchange for finished goods that came out of Asia, China in particular. So that kind of triangular relationship in commercial terms is replicated today. Obviously, there are details in certain sectors and it's different and all of those kinds of things. And yet it just sort of knocks you back when you look at the basic pattern and see that at play. I think that the technology transfer is an aspiration and a goal. Indeed, there were efforts even as far back as the 1700s to try to wrest some of of that trade away from China and Asia, or Europe for that matter, but China and Asia in particular, and develop their own localized silk industry in Mexico. And this was this effort on the part, that's the sort of agency dimension of local actors in this within Mexico. But those kinds of things in the end they didn't work. The other element might be the communities themselves. The communities that have sprung up in the wake of the 19th century migration were of course known, particularly in Lima and Peru and the like, as integrated into society. But at the same time, they had a kind of sense of isolation from the China of their grandparents, and so on. What's happened today is we've seen China, which has an explicit policy for mobilizing the diaspora, right, reaching out to these communities, they reinvigorating with a sense of pride of who they are and the like, as their connection with China. And that becomes one of the points of contact, of local knowledge exchange, sometimes commercial exchange, and the like. So these I think are some of those elements that carry over from the past into the present day.
I will add to that, and I think Chris is absolutely right. Perhaps more contemporary issues, the U.S. view of China has permeated the region for a long time, and I believe that started changing in 1979 when the Carter administration recognized the PRC. We see a number of countries doing the same afterwards. In other words, Latin American countries have been traditionally looking up to Washington to read what happens with the external world, and I think that's a very important element. And as Chris mentioned, the connection with many people who are from Chinese descent in the region. In Peru is a very interesting case, and Chris and I actually wrote an edition on Peruvian Chinese foreign policy, which highlights the importance of these communities in these particular countries, which in many cases have not been integrated into the political elites. Most of them are economic business elites, but not necessarily into the decision making. And one of the recommendations we were giving the Peruvians was to incorporate a lot of Peruvian Chinese citizens to their foreign service, for example, because a lot of them already speak the language, they have the experience and the knowledge to deal with China. And that's also the case in other countries such as Panama, quite an important element. But in all of this, I would argue still the way that countries look at the issue of Taiwan, which I think is still influenced by the U.S. And when we saw a number of countries in Latin America from 2017 onwards switching to Taiwan, the U.S. reacted. Pompeo went to Panama to tell countries off of not doing so. But of course, countries were not very happy with that because, countries are allowed to decide who do they want to have diplomatic ties with. So there's a rejection and change of dynamics with the U.S., which I think is one of the themes that we're going to be discussing later on.
Thank you both for highlighting some of those aspects. I admit I knew about the community in Peru, and it makes a lot of sense, that recommendation, particularly given the difficulty of learning languages. But I was surprised to learn in the book about the substantial community in Panama, and particularly, for example, like some of the food being very much derived from or very similar to Chinese food. So I think that's a really important point to make. Before we move on to talking about some of the countries in particular, I was wondering if there's anything in addition about the Cold War era in particular we want to mention. I know we've sort of talked a bit about it already, but anything else we want to say?
I think to add perhaps to emphasize the importance of some of these issues, but also to understand how Chinese policymakers started to understand how the ties with the U.S. for Latin Americans were not that strong. 1958, Vice President Nixon went to Peru, and he went to the university, local university in Lima, and Vice President Nixon thought students there from the left were there to welcome him, and to later realize that they were protesting against him. China has been aware of this relationship with the U.S., and they have been aware about how weak the relationship is. And I think, this is a point that policymakers in China have in many ways capitalized on, because they're a new actor in the region, new in the sense versus the U.S. as we know, they're not that new, but diplomatically, they know that the U.S. has a lot of dirty laundry in the region. And for that reason, they capitalize on this in the sense that they don't have that much of that. But also, they only have to be marginally better than the U.S. to be, you know, seen as a different, more benign actor.
And I think, too, that this influenced this drive for an alternative, that there is a, it's a kind of classic balance of power type politics, or logic that derives here, that you're you are looking for an alternative source of influence, power, resources, what have you, and that China slots in with that quite well, particularly given the developmental emphasis. So much more so than, say, some of the European countries would at this equivalent period. So I think that this and the sense that China is cast as the future, and that the United States and the West more generally is seen to be in decline. So that also, for developing countries which are emphasizing progress, they're trying to move forward into a better tomorrow, China seems to have captured that better tomorrow. That's at least how the rhetoric reads, and indeed some of the economic statistics bear that out as well.
I think one of the important things, Chris, about that answer is not just what you actually said, but how you phrased it, that putting the agency emphasis on the Latin American countries looking for this from China. They want this. And I think too often it's easy to think of everything is about what China wants. And of course, that's part of the equation, but that's not the only thing that determines how these relationships develop, as evidenced in the book when you both compare the policies of Chile, Peru, and Argentina and look at the strategic choices that these countries are making in what they're trying to do with their relationships with China. So I was wondering if you could maybe do a little bit of compare and contrast for us between these countries and the choices they're making.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. The relationship is not just about China. Can you hear me? I think this is absolutely right. The relationship is not just about China. You have different stories, different strategies. And, well, there are a number of issues that are difficult for the region. The clarity of China is much better than the clarity of the region with Latin America, partly because we have very short-term mentality in Latin America. Therefore, it's difficult for the region to form a clear strategy for the long term versus China, who has that obvious advantage. But also I think there are good lessons to learn. Chile has been a country that has developed a good relationship with China, but also strategically has had opportunities to enforce its agency, to impact with its agency. For example, their support for China to enter the WTO, you know, was exceptional and very, very important. And the way they have also managed to enter markets in China, the market with their wines and not just focusing on natural resources. Because one of the problems, and I think these three cases that you mentioned, is the fact that the most important thing they trade with China is natural resources. In the case of Peru and Chile, of course, copper. But it is important to highlight the advantage and the good elements of that relationship that they're not just simply about natural resources. And I think Chile would be a very good example.
I think, too, in a way, Chile had the first mover advantage, and they jumped, they retained under Allende, they had actually recognized China formally, but they retain that even during, it shows a level of pragmatism even in the grip of military rule. They retain that, and pragmatism on both sides. Most countries of the socialist left or what have you would cut ties with the Pinochet regime, but Beijing and Chile, Santiago carried on in that way. This first mover advantage was an important way for them to position themselves. Peru, in a way, comes in later, right? And it's almost a late mover advantage. They could do things with China because resources. They had the examples of other countries, in particular, the rivalry that is traditional between Peru and Chile. They could look over their shoulder and see what Chile had done, and they could they could then craft, for instance, an FTA, a free trade agreement, which was more, which resonated more closely with contemporary economic ties and also with their own experience and needs, something that Chile had to readjust a little bit later. So there is that element. For Argentina, I mean, in a sense, the absence of a clear policy presides, as opposed to Peru and Chile, that there the cycles of political change dominate within the country, dominated how they approach China, and so they certainly saw the opportunism there, but at the same time that relationship was shaped by the swings and falls of the currency, the crises that were associated with that. And yet the interesting thing is throughout, there was this level of confidence building between Argentine elites and their Chinese counterparts, such that the relationship has assumed over 20 some years then a very of the contemporary relationship. It's been it's become quite a lodestar. It's been quite an important one for China. And the fact that Argentina is now being considered to be for the BRICS is a arrangement, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa grouping is a testimonial to the positive relationships that they've been able to develop with China over time.
Absolutely. I think Chris is absolutely right on this. But just to also add that after Cuba, the countries that follow establishing diplomatic ties are Chile in 1970, then you have Peru in 1971, then you have Mexico in 1972, Argentina also in 1972. Basically, these are early movers diplomatically, but I think strategically that came a little bit later. And Chris is absolutely right in that sense. The changes of dynamics in the region, and as he mentioned, the new development bank, the BRICS Bank, which is based in Shanghai, has expanded. So now you have not only five members, the founding members, but you have at the moment four additional members, one of them from Latin America. That's Uruguay, which is in the process of completing its membership. And Argentina is trying to become a member. And, you know, we'll see if that actually happens in the next year. But China has been willing to support that bid from Argentina.
I think that's such an interesting grouping of countries to put together for exactly the factors that you've both just mentioned. And in some ways, it was kind of an interesting group to start with, because at least from my perspective as more of a knowing more about China than Latin America, I didn't really think of them together the way that I think of this next group of countries as probably having some sort of similarity, which is, of course, the Bolivarian Republics of Venezuela, Ecuador, and Bolivia. I wasn't hugely surprised to see them grouped together. Made sense to me, at least from what I know of their policies and history. I was more surprised, and to be honest, a bit amused, to read in the book the description from the both of you that China has sometimes been wary of or surprised by and sometimes even concerned about its relationship with these three countries. And I was very much persuaded of this interpretation after reading the chapter. So I was wondering if you could maybe tell us a little bit about China's reaction to these three relationships.
I think it starts with Hugo Chavez's trip reaching out to and his trip to Beijing, where he launches into a sort of celebratory, you know, Mao himself, and clearly unaware that the Deng Xiaoping era and the like has been really about opening up the door of criticism. Of course, today, Xi Jinping is bringing some of that celebratory position back. But in that period, it was something that they didn't expect. They didn't see that as a, you know, they themselves didn't recognize the power of the politics of the past, the left and the like. And you know, we see in similar ways that language appearing in Bolivia, to a lesser degree, with Ecuador, because Correa was an economist by training, and he though willing to use that language, he wasn't he had a different approach. But nonetheless, this open-armed rhetoric translated into for particularly for Venezuela and the other two countries as well, a willingness to open policy doors, encourage licenses, risk investments in areas that might not have otherwise been accessible to China. So I think that they were taken aback by that, and they were uncertain how to respond to it, favorably. But their own personal history of an understanding during the Deng Xiaoping Jiang Zemin period was, this was about turning your back on the policies of Mao. So it caught them at off guard.
Yeah, that's a very good point that Chris mentions. I think the argument also includes the fact that there are massive debts from this country to China. And my understanding from policymakers we've spoken, China is worried about getting that money back, naturally. And I think the case of Venezuela should be highlighted there, where a lot of the debt that is owed to China was not necessarily approved by Parliament, by Congress in Venezuela. So it's a debt that could perfectly well be dismissed by a new government in case, obviously, that government may arrive, which, of course, we saw that with Guaido, sort of the alternative president of Venezuela. And there were reports that actually Guaido from Venezuela met with policymakers from China. Now, these are reports that, difficult to confirm, but reliable people were reporting about this in different circles, which tells me and tells us that China is worried about that and that they would like to continue a relationship with Venezuela. And I think that is geared to the fact that China wants its money back from the money that they lent Venezuela. Also, to add here, countries like Venezuela and Bolivia have proved to be a little bit more complicated to deal with China. For example, both of these countries pledged to join the AIB a very long time ago and with very ambitious memberships. They haven't done it. And I think, given the current circumstances, I think it would be quite difficult for them to complete that membership. So I think they're proving to be less reliable, perhaps, than other countries. In the case of Ecuador, I think it's very different. You're moving forward. You have presidents who have given a lot of importance to China, some of them quite controversial because China invested in many different projects in the country, some of which have phenomenally failed. And so that's very, very difficult. But the last president that we have now, President Lasso, is right now actually about to sign an FTA that has concluded being negotiated between Beijing and Quito in a space of 11 months. So we should expect to have a new FTA that will be the fourth FTA of China with countries in the region, starting with Chile, then Peru, Costa Rica, and I believe Ecuador soon to be the case.
Great. Thank you for explaining that, where it came from, Chris, and then what it's doing now, Alvaro, and even where it might go into the future. Very helpful understanding of that set of relationships. So moving then northwards, I would love to pick up on something one of you mentioned earlier, the idea of the Caribbean being a particular area for US influence. How then and why does China work to build relationships in this part of Latin America, given the kind of, I suppose, extra trickiness of it in some senses?
That's a very good way of putting it. I think because China wants to send a message that they are not afraid to get involved with countries in the Caribbean. And I think that is a sort of an important message to the US. You see, when Xi Jinping went to the region for the first time, the first country in which he actually visited was Trinidad and Tobago. Then he went, that's in 2013, right after he had been, arrived to power in China. Trinidad and Tobago, then he went to Costa Rica and Mexico. Then he he actually went to the US. So I'm saying this for the following reason. We experienced at that particular time the US pivot to Asia by Obama. And I think the message here was, you can mess with my orbit from China. We can also mess with yours. And I think that's an important element in the Caribbean. But also the depth. You go back, Cuba was the first country to establish diplomatic ties. But also China luring a lot of these countries to also switch ties, such as the Dominican Republic in 2018, and so on. So I think that's an important element to take into account. Just to finish, although the U.S. is a very important actor in these particular countries, there is also the massive element of neglect, meaning the U.S. doesn't really necessarily give any priority to the region. And I think we will discuss this question later. But I think that's part of the reason why China sees an opportunity here by a number of countries that, will be open to be closer to them for that reason.
Yeah, I think that this... diplomatic complacency that characterizes the U.S. role to a region which historically and in contemporary terms is recognized to be important for the security of the United States, if it's in a longer term sort of view, that it's quite remarkable the degree to which China has been able to operate in there. And it speaks as well to the complacency of the U.S., the buying into the idea that China is an economic actor first and foremost. Again, part of that complacency is because domestically the growing ties and commercial links with the U.S. and China was the period when we began to see it. It was built upon that period, and so it would be as Americans, people in the U.S. became more uncomfortable with and called into question that bilateral relationship, they began to look anew at Central America and the islands of the Caribbean and where China's positioning there. But up till that time, they didn't see it. It was standing in front of them, but they didn't see it that way.
Hmm. So then getting to the point that Alvaro hinted at a little bit, could you both tell us, maybe even up to sort of now, how the US is reacting to China's engagement in the Caribbean, but also in Latin America more broadly?
Of course, yeah, I'm happy to do that. Well, let me just start by saying that the US has neglected the region massively. I think one of the things Latin Americans feel unhappy about with the U.S. is the fact that we feel that, and I'm Latin American, by the way, I'm from Colombia, that the U.S. see us as their backyard, therefore has never been a priority. This is way before China started interacting with the region, so it's important to argue that and to highlight that. Now, one of the things that we actually see in more recent times is still the same neglect. I think Washington takes for granted that we are close to them, and as Chris hinted as well, they only see China's presence in the region as an economic factor. Speaking with a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for the region, there is a bureau called Western Hemisphere Affairs in the State Department. I was asking him about China's presence in Latin America, and this is in 2014. And his answer was, this is good for the U.S. because that means more money from China than Latin Americans will spend in the U.S., which is not the case. It's sort of really arrogant attitude from their part and neglect. And to finish with this, she has visited more countries than Obama, Trump, and Biden combined. Imagine that, 13 countries in total, which highlights the low priority that the U.S. gives the region, and probably that will continue for many, many decades. I don't think that's going to change. Then you have a new China that is willing to be there, that is willing to interact with the region. And I think that is very seen as a very positive element by Latin American countries.
Anything you'd like to add, Chris?
I think that the diplomatic dimension is not recognized. Leaders in office, they gain a level of legitimacy and prestige from international interaction, particularly with a great power. And if that great power is China and lavishing on the attention and the like, this you know, is welcomed. It helps them bolster their own position within amongst their domestic populations and the like, and give them a way to overshadow their political opponents. So I think these things matter. I think that also we can touch on Panama, perhaps as one of those turning points, because Panama historically had, of course, been the canal was a U.S. possession and was indicative of the blending of commercial power and military ascendancy in the U.S. from the early 20th century onward. And the fact that that China was involved as out of Hong Kong initially, commercial actors in that way, but eventually in the diplomatic domain as well in 2017, that this demonstrated to people in Washington that this was a sort of wake-up call for people in Washington, that the world of Latin America, as they had understood it, was changing and turning very, very much towards an alternative, and that inspired some of the hand-wringing that we saw and Pompeo's visit, those sort of things.
Yeah, I think Chris is right on pointing to the example of Panama and how Panama in many ways reopened the door to establish ties with Beijing rather than to leave Taipei to establish ties with Beijing. And we saw a number of countries that follow, including the Dominican Republic, El Salvador, and the last one was Nicaragua. The Chinese were not that excited with Nicaragua because the Nicaraguans had already switched from Taiwan to Beijing in 1985 and then went back afterwards 5 years later. So then, therefore, you know, there is not a great deal of celebration in China. But that brings the number to 25 countries, which brings me to the next point, which is, I mentioned before, Taiwan. And this is important for the U.S. Taiwan only has 14 countries that recognize their status, right? Out of those four countries, one is the Vatican, so you might not necessarily count them as a country. But the important here, the magic number, is Latin America. Out of the 14 countries that recognize Taiwan, eight are in Latin America. That's a very important element. It still has an important voice. And we believe that that number will become smaller in many aspects. We don't know who it is. People oftentimes ask us who is going to be the next country switching diplomatic ties from Taiwan to China. And we don't know. But there are elements highlighting that, you know, domestic politics in these countries matter. The election in Paraguay in April is important. Paraguay is the only country in South America that still has diplomatic ties with Taiwan. And the issue of recognizing Taiwan or China is now part of the election because the current president wants to stay with Taiwan. In fact, he went to Taiwan last week. And the contenders are all arguing that they want to switch their country to China. So we'll see what happens. But it's interesting to see these dynamics now playing an important part and will continue to do so for the next few years, I believe.
Can I jump in on a point, Miranda, just more generally, which is part of the relationship, and this isn't a Central America, this is the whole of the continent, just that we need to put up front is how fast trade has grown in a period of less than 20 years. Trade has gone from 12.17 billion to over 307 billion, and this is just shows how there were markets across the continent that were not really being developed as much as they could be, and that that China's resources, particularly its the lending policy or its infrastructure for resources loan-based loans were of great appeal to the different economies. And that's true for small countries, island country like Jamaica, and it's true for larger countries like Brazil, that in both cases that they saw in China an economic partner whose resources could be channeled to respond to and solve problems that they had, be it upgrading a road across the island, which was the case in Jamaica, or more investment into extractive mining or resources in the Northeast. So this general economic dimension has helped lubricate the relationship, which the diplomatic relationship as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's very important to mention, and that impressive figures, which go back to China accessing the WTO in 2001. That's partly one of the factors explaining this massive trade and the FTAs and so on, and the new FTAs that we may see in the future, perhaps also Uruguay, including Uruguay, which is a country that is part of Mercosur. It's not allowed to negotiate bilateral FTAs, but they're doing so because there is an important economic benefit. China is the largest trading partner of Uruguay, Brazil, Peru, and Chile. They are the largest trading partner of South America as a whole. The U.S. still has an important monopoly on that. But I think the U.S. changing, as we speak, ground in the region trade-wise, but I also think soft power-wise. And I think the policymakers and perhaps experts in Washington are starting to wake up to that reality that, you know, what are the implications for this? And I think that's an important element to mention, including elements that I see geopolitically oriented, such as the membership of six countries in the region of the AIB, which, as you may know, the AIB is seen as a political tool by the Chinese to take over the financial infrastructure of the world, in the sense of the replacement of the World Bank. In fact, one of the fears when the bank was established was that the AIB was going to make the World Bank put it in danger. Now they're working together, but six countries from the region are members of this particular infrastructure bank.
I think too that one of the if Panama was a kind of geopolitical turning point, the free trade of the Americas, the failure of the U.S.-led free trade of the Americas was a kind of economic turning point back in 2005. And that was the point at which, you know, that we see an acceleration of Chinese investment in aggregate form. There'd been Chinese interest and economic involvement, as, of course, preceding that. But we see a more comprehensive approach and we see the free trade areas beginning agreements being struck as the United States started to do as a follow up to this failure of the free trade of the area of the Americas, signing on to bilateral free trade agreements. So I think that these sort of touchstones are the points where we see the relationship accelerate or change.
Well, now that you've both explained to us the historical ties between China and Latin America, some of the more contemporary legacies that are still relevant, and of course, now in this last answer, you've predicted the future, or at least predicted what we should look out for in the future in these multiple different relationships. This leads me to ask only my final question, which is there anything that we as listeners can look out for in the future from either or of you? Anything you're currently working on or looking to work on next, whether or not it's related to this topic, that you'd like our listeners to be aware of?
Yes, of course. Chris and I are working on specific cases at the moment, which again is very important to highlight that you know the diversity of very different countries in the region. We're working on China and Ecuador at the moment, China and Panama as well, China and Colombia, looking at the specifics of these particular cases, and we will continue to do so. We also look at the interactions of the development banks from China into the region. The new development bank specifically, we're working on a project at the moment, an article that will be coming out soon. And also the interaction of the AIB I'm working on and issues of sustainability and projects that they might have in the future.
Yes, I just agree with Alvaro on those points.
Anything either of you are working on individually you'd like to highlight?
Yes, I'm looking at the moment on the work on the NDB that we're doing is not together. I am working on the expansion of the NDB, specifically in Uruguay, and how that would be a very important element for the future, because it may open the door for Argentina and other countries to join. While I'm doing that, of course, highlighting the role of Brazilian agency in the whole process and the developments that we have seen in the last, you know, year or so with the comeback of Lula, the fact that he has replaced the president of the New Development Bank with a Brazilian former president, Dilma Rousseff. So this is the sort of things that I'm looking at the moment, to see that expansion in terms of cooperation and in terms of membership with countries in the region. Chris?
Yeah, I think an area that it bears examining would be the security area, because how it manifests, it doesn't manifest in the way that we've seen in for instance, China, Africa. But there are risk and security challenges that, as seen through, as seen by China and in the region, and how they address those. So I think that's something in the future that I might be pursuing.
Absolutely. That's a very important element. We have done some work on that, examining the implications for countries like France of China's presence in the Caribbean. Why? Because France has two very important departments in elements of territory, French Guiana and Guadeloupe. And the French have a very important contingency and military presence in the Caribbean, 3,100 soldiers in total, military personnel. The U.S. doesn't have a base in Latin America. The SOUTHCOM command that used to be based in Panama now is based out of Miami. So that's an important element to take into account. And more developments that are happening in that particular security area. Chris is absolutely right.
So lots of fascinating things then to look forward to. Thank you both for sharing those. But while you're off working on them, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, again, titled China and Latin America, Development Agency Geopolitics, published by Bloomsbury. Chris and Alvaro, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for the invitation.